Magnuson said. "How can that be?" Hatch asked. "The flood tunnels have all been sealed. No water can get into the pit." Needleman spoke into the radio. "Streeter, what's the red line on those pumps?"
40,000 is the rating, sir," came the response.
"I didn't ask what they were rated to. I asked where the red line was."
50,000.
"But, Captain," he turned to Magnuson, "do it." Outside, the roar of the pump engines became almost deafening, and the tower shook violently from their effort. Nobody spoke as all eyes were locked on the monitors. As Hatch watched, the blue line steadied once again and wavered, almost seeming to drop a bit. He exhaled gradually, realizing he had been holding his breath.
"Grande mer du noir,"
Bonterre whispered. In disbelief, Hatch saw the level in the pit begin to rise again. "We're back at 10 feet, Magnuson said implacably. "Give me 60 on the pumps," Needleman said.
"Sir!"
The voice of Streeter crackled over the radio.
"We can't push the—"
"Do it!" Needleman barked at Magnuson, his voice hard, his lips compressed into narrow white lines. The engineer resolutely turned the dials. Once again, Hatch found himself drawn to the observation port. Below, he could see Streeter's team bolting additional metal straps around the pump hose, which was twitching and thrashing like a live thing. Hatch tensed, aware that if the hose burst, the water pressure at 60,000 gallons per minute could cut a person in two. The roar of the pumps had become a howl, a banshee-like cry that seemed to fill his head with its pressure. He could feel the island shuddering under his feet. Small bits of dirt shook free from the mouth of the pit and dropped into the dark, roiling water below. The green line wavered, but did not sink.
"Captain!"
Streeter cried again.
"The forward seal is beginning to fail!"
Needleman stood motionless, staring into the pit as if transfixed.
"Captain!"
The voice of Streeter cried over the radio, struggling above the noise.
"If the hose blows, it could take out Orthanc!"
As Hatch opened his mouth to speak, Needleman turned abruptly toward Magnuson.
"Kill the pumps," he said.
In the descending silence that followed, Hatch could hear the groans and whispers of the water pit beneath them.
"Water level returning to normal, sir," Magnuson said without turning from her console.
"This is bullshit, man,"
Rankin muttered, snapping through sonar readings.
"We sealed all 5 tunnels. This is going to be one hell of a problem."
Needleman half turned his head at this, and Hatch could see the chiseled profile, the hard glitter in the eyes.
"It's not a problem," he said in a low, strange voice. "We'll simply do what McCallan did. We'll coffer down the shore."
Chapter 20. At 9:45 that evening, Hatch emerged from the boarding hatch of the Cerberus and walked across the gangway to his own boat. At the end of the working day, he'd motored over to the big ship to inspect the CBC machine he'd be using if blood work was needed for any of the expedition members. While on board, he'd struck up a conversation with the Lass's quartermaster, and in short order had been invited to stay for dinner in the ship's galley and to meet the half-dozen occupants. At last, full of vegetable lasagna and espresso, he'd said his farewells to the easygoing crewmen and lab technicians and headed back through the white corridors toward the exit hatch. Along the way, he'd passed the door to Wapner's stateroom. For a moment, he'd considered checking in with the programmer, but decided the unpleasant reception he was sure to get outweighed the benefits of a status report. Now, back on the Plain Jane, he powered up the engine, cast off the lines, and pointed the boat into the warm night. The distant lights of the mainland were strung out across the dark, and a nearer cluster on Ragged Island glowed softly through the mantle of mist. Venus hung low over the western horizon, reflected in the water as a wavering thread of white. The motor ran a little roughly, but eased as Hatch moved the throttle forward. A glowing trail of phosphorescence sprang from the boat's stern, sparks swirling from a green fire. Hatch sighed contentedly, looking forward to the placid journey ahead
despite the lateness of the hour. Suddenly, the roughness returned. Quickly, Hatch cut the motor and let the boat drift. Feels like water in the fuel line, he thought. With a sigh, he went forward for a flashlight and some tools, then returned to the cockpit and pulled up the deck pads, exposing the engine beneath. He licked the beam about, searching for the fuel water separator. Locating it, he reached in and unscrewed the small bowl. Sure enough, it was full of dark liquid. Emptying it over the side, he bent forward again to replace it. Then he stopped. In the silence left by the killing of his engine, Hatch could make out a sound, coming toward him out of the nocturnal stillness. He paused and listened, uncomprehending for a moment. Then he recognized it. A woman's voice, low and melodious, singing an enchanting aria. He stood up and turned involuntarily in the direction of the voice. It floated across the dark waves, bewitchingly out of place, ravishing in its note of sweet suffering. Hatch waited, listening as if transfixed. As he looked across the expanse of water, he saw it was coming from the dark form of the Griffin, its running lights extinguished. A single point of red glowed out from Needleman's vessel. Through his binoculars he could see it was the captain, smoking his pipe on the forward deck. Hatch closed the deck pads, then tried the engine again. It sprang to life on the second crank, running sweet and clear. Hatch eased the throttle forward and, on an impulse, moved slowly toward the Griffin.
"Evening," said the captain as he approached, the quiet voice unnaturally clear in the night air.
"And to you, too," said Hatch, putting the Plain Jane into neutral.
"I'd bet my eye teeth that's Mozart, but I don't know the opera. The Marriage of Figaro, perhaps?"
The captain shook his head.
"It's Zeffiretti Lusingeri."
"Ah, from Idomeneo."
"Yes. Sylvia McNair sings it beautifully, doesn't she? Are you a fan of opera?"
"My mother was.
Every Saturday afternoon, the radio would fill our house with trios and tuttis. I've only learned to appreciate it these last 5 years or so." There was a moment of silence.
"Care to come aboard?" Needleman asked suddenly. Hatch tied the Plain Jane to the rail, killed the engine, and hopped over, the captain giving him a hand up. There was a glow from the pipe, and Needleman's face was briefly illuminated with a reddish aura, accentuating the hollows of his cheeks and eyes. A wink of precious metal shone from the pilot house as the curl of gold reflected the moonlight. They stood at the rail, silent, listening to the final dying notes of the aria. When it ended and the recitative began, Needleman breathed deeply, then rapped out his dawdle on the side of the boat.
"Why haven't you ever asked me to quit smoking?" he asked. "Every doctor I've ever known has tried to get me to quit, except you."
Hatch considered this.
"It seems to me I'd be wasting my breath."
Needleman gave a soft laugh.
"You know me well enough, then. Shall we go below for a glass of port?"
Hatch shot a surprised glance at the captain. Just that night, in the galley of the Cerberus, he'd heard that nobody was ever invited below on the Griffin, that nobody, in fact, even knew what it looked like. The captain, although personable and friendly with his crew, always kept his distance.
"Good thing I didn't start lecturing you on your vices, isn't it?" Hatch said. "Thanks, I'd love a glass of port."
He followed Needleman into the pilot house, then down the steps and under the low door. Another narrow half-flight of metal stairs, another door, and Hatch found himself in a large, low-ceilinged room. He looked around in wonder. The paneling was a rich, lustrous mahogany, carved in Georgian style and inlaid with mother-of-pearl. Delicate Tiffany-stained glass was set into each porthole, and leather banquettes were placed against the walls. At the far end, a small fire glowed, filling the cabin with warmth and the faint, fragrant smell of birch. Glass-fronted library cabinets flanked either side of the mantelpiece. Hatch could see bound calfskin and the gleam of gold stamping. He moved forward to examine the titles. Hakluyt's Voyages, an early copy of Newton's Principia. Here and there, priceless illuminated manuscripts and other incunabula were arranged face outward. Hatch recognized a fine copy of Les Trericheurs du Duc de Berry. There was also a small shelf devoted to original editions of early pirate texts. Lionel Wafer's Bachelor's Delight, Alexander Esquemelian's Buccaneers of America, and A General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates by Charles Johnson. The library alone must have cost a small fortune. Hatch wondered if Needleman had furnished the boat with earnings from prior salvages. Beside one of the cabinets was a small seascape in a gilt frame. Hatch moved in for a closer look. Then he drew in his breath sharply.
"My God," he said. "This is a Turner, isn't it?"
Needleman nodded. "It's a study for his painting, Squall off Beachy Head, 1874.
"That's the one in the Tate?" Hatch said.
"When I was in London a few years back, I tried sketching it several times." "Are you a painter?" Needleman asked.
"I'm a dabbler. Watercolors, mostly."
Hatch stepped back, glancing around again. The other pictures that hung on the walls were not paintings, but precise copperplate engravings of botanical specimens. Heavy flowers, odd grasses, exotic plants. Needleman approached a small, baize-covered dry sink, laid with cut-glass ship's decanters and small glasses. Pulling two tumblers from their felt-covered moorings, he poured a few fingers of port in each. "Those engravings," he said, following Hatch's gaze, "are by Sir Joseph Banks, the botanist who accompanied Captain Cook on his first voyage around the world. They're plant specimens he collected in Botany Bay, shortly after they discovered Australia. It was the fantastic variety of plant specimens, you know, that caused Banks to give the bay its name."
"They're beautiful,"
murmured Hatch, accepting a glass. "They're probably the finest copperplate engravings ever made." What a fortunate man he was. A botanist, given the gift of a brand new continent.
"Are you interested in botany?" Hatch asked.
"I'm interested in brand new continents," Needleman said, staring into the fire. "But I was born a little too late. All those have been snapped up." He smiled quickly, covering what seemed like a wistful gleam in his eyes. "But in the water pit you have a mystery worthy of attention." "Yes," Needleman replied. "Perhaps the only one left. That's why I suppose setbacks such as today's shouldn't dismay me. Great mysteries don't yield up their secrets easily." There was a long silence as Hatch sipped his port. Most people he knew found silence in a conversation to be uncomfortable, but Needleman seemed to welcome it. "I meant to ask you," the captain said at last, "what did you think of our reception in town yesterday?"
"By and large, everyone seems happy with our presence here.
We're certainly a boon to local business."
"Yes," Needleman replied, "but what do you mean, by and large?"
"Well, not everyone's a merchant." Hatch decided there was no point in being evasive. "We seem to have aroused the moral opposition of the local minister." Needleman gave a wry smile. "The minister disapproves, does he? After 2,000 years of murder, inquisition, and intolerance, it's a wonder any Christian minister still feels he holds the moral high ground." Hatch shifted a little uncomfortably. This was a voluble Needleman, quite unlike the cold figure that just a few hours before had ordered the pumps run at a critically dangerous level. "They told Columbus his ship would fall off the earth, and they forced Galileo to publicly repudiate his greatest discovery." Needleman fished his pipe out of his pocket and went through the elaborate ritual of lighting it. "My father was a Lutheran minister himself," he said more quietly, shaking out the match. "I had quite enough to last me a lifetime."
"You don't believe in God?" Hatch asked.
Needleman gazed at Hatch in silence. Then he lowered his head. "To be honest, I've often wished I did," Religion played such a large role in my childhood that being without it now myself sometimes feels like a void. But I'm the kind of person who cannot believe in the absence of proof. It isn't something I have any control over. I must have proof. He sipped his port. Why? Do you have any religious beliefs? Hatch turned toward him. Well, yes, I do. Needleman waited, smoking. But I don't care to discuss them. A smile spread over Needleman's face. Excellent. Can I give you a dividend? Hatch handed over his glass. That wasn't the only opposing voice I heard in town, he continued. I have an old friend, a teacher of natural history, who thinks we're going to fail. And you? Needleman asked coolly, busy with the port, not looking at him. I wouldn't be in it if I thought we'd fail. But I'd be lying if I said today's setback didn't give me pause. Malin, Needleman said almost gently as he returned the glass. I can't blame you for that. I confess to feeling a moment of something like despair when the pumps failed us. But there's not the slightest doubt in my mind that we'll succeed. I see now where we've gone wrong. I suppose there are even more than 5 flood tunnels, Hatch said. Or maybe some hydraulic trick was played on us. Undoubtedly. But that's not what I mean. You see, we've been focusing all our attention on the water pit. But I've realized the water pit is not our adversary. Hatch raised his eyebrows inquiringly, and the captain turned toward him, pipe clenched in one fist, eyes glittering brightly. It's not the pit. It's the man. McCallan, the designer. He's been one step ahead of us all the way. He's anticipated our moves, and those who came before us. Placing his glass on a felt-topped table, he walked over to the wall and swung open a wood panel, revealing a small safe. He punched several buttons on the adjoining keypad, and the safe door swung open. He reached inside, removed something, then turned and laid it on the table in front of Hatch. It was a quarto volume, bound in leather. McCallan's book, On Sacred Structures. The captain opened it with great care, caressing it with long fingers. There in the margins, next to the printed blocks of text, appeared a neat little hand in a pale brown wash that looked almost like watercolor. Line after line of monotonous characters, broken only by the occasional small, deft mechanical drawing of various joints, arches, braces, and cribbing. Needleman tapped the page. If the pit is McCallan's armor, then this is the soft joint where we can slip in the knife. Very soon now, we'll have the second half of the code deciphered. And with it, the key to the treasure.
How can you be so sure this journal contains the secret to the pit? Hatch asked.
Because nothing else makes sense. Why else would he have kept a secret journal, not only in code, but written in an invisible ink? Remember, Red Ned Occam needed McCallan to create an impregnable fortress for his treasure. A fortress that would not only resist looters, but would physically endanger them by drowning or crushing or whatever. But you don't create a bomb without knowing how to disarm it first. So McCallan would have had to create a secret way for Occam himself to remove his treasure when he chose. A hidden tunnel, perhaps, or a way to defuse the traps. It stands to reason McCallan would keep a record of it. He leveled his gaze at his guest. But this journal holds more than just the key to the pit. It gives us a window into the man's mind. And it is the man we must defeat. He spoke in the same low, strangely forceful tone that Hatch remembered from earlier in the day. Hatch bent over the book, inhaling the aroma of mildew, leather, dust, and dry rot.
One thing surprises me, he said. And that's the thought of an architect, kidnapped and forced to work for pirates on some godforsaken island, having the presence of mind to keep a secret journal. Needleman nodded slowly. It's not the act of a faint-hearted man. Perhaps he wanted to leave a record for posterity of his most ingenious structure. I suppose it's hard to say what motivated him exactly. After all, the man was a bit of a cipher himself. There's a gap of 3 years in the historical record, following his leaving Cambridge, during which he seems to have disappeared. And his personal life as a whole remains a mystery. Take a look at this dedication. He carefully turned to the title page of the book, then slid it toward Hatch. With grateful admiration for showing the way, the author respectfully dedicates this humble work to Etta Onis. We've searched high and low, but haven't been able to determine the identity of this Etta Onis, Needleman went on. Was she McAllen's teacher? Confidant? Mistress? He carefully closed the book. It's the same with the rest of his life. I'm embarrassed to say that until you came along, I'd never even heard of the man, Hatch said. Most people haven't. But in his day, he was a brilliant visionary, a true Renaissance man. He was born in 1657, the illegitimate but favored son of an earl. Like Milton, he claimed to have read every book then published in English, Latin, and Greek. He read law at Cambridge and was being groomed for a bishopric, but then apparently had some kind of secret conversion to Catholicism. He turned his attention to the arts, natural philosophy, and mathematics. And he was an extraordinary athlete, supposedly able to fling a coin so that it rang out against the vault of his largest cathedral. Needleman stood up, returned to the safe, and placed the volume within it. And an interest in hydraulics seems to extend through all his work. In this book, he describes an ingenious aqueduct and siphon system he designed to supply water to Hounsbury Cathedral. He also sketched out a hydraulic system for locks on the Severn Canal. It was never built. It seemed a crazy idea at the time. But Magnuson did some modeling and believes it would have worked. Did Occam seek him out deliberately? Needleman smiled. Tempting to think so, isn't it? But highly doubtful. It was probably one of those fateful coincidences of history. Hatch nodded toward the safe. And how did you happen to come across that volume? Was that also a coincidence? Needleman's smile widened. No, not exactly. When I first started looking into the Ragged Island treasure, I did some research into Occam. You know that when his command ship was found floating derelict, all hands dead, it was towed into Plymouth and its contents sold at public auction. We managed to dig up the auctioneer's list at the London Public Records Office, and on it were the contents of a captain's chest full of books. Occam was an educated man, and I assumed this must be his personal library. One volume, On Sacred Structures, caught my eye. It stood out among the maps, French pornography, and naval works that made up the rest of the library. It took 3 years on and off, but we finally managed to track that volume down in a heap of rotting books in the undercroft of a half-ruined kirk in Glenfarclane, Scotland. He stood closer to the fire and spoke in a voice that was low, almost dreamlike. I'll never forget opening that book for the first time, and realizing that the ugly soiling in the margins was a white ink, only then becoming perceivable through the ravages of time and rot. At that moment, I knew that the water pit and its treasure were going to be mine. He fell silent, his pipe dead, the glowing coals of the fire weaving a mazy light through the darkening room. Chapter 21 Kerry Wapner walked jauntily up the cobbled street, whistling the theme from Star Wars. Every now and then he would stop long enough to snort derisively at the shop fronts he passed.
Useless, all of them. Like that coast-to-coast hardware store there, sporting dusty tools and yard implements old enough to be pre-industrial. He knew full well there wasn't a decent software store within 300 miles. As for bagels, he'd have to cross at least 2 state lines before he found anyone who even knew what the damn word meant. He stopped abruptly in front of a crisp white Victorian structure. This had to be it, even if it did look more like an old house than a post office. The large American flag that hung from the porch and the Stormhaven ME 04564 sign sunk into the front lawn were dead giveaways. Opening the screen door, Wapner realized that it was a house. The post office itself took up the front parlor, while a strong smell of cooking indicated that domesticity was hidden farther within. He looked around the small room, shaking his head at the ancient bank of P.O. boxes and decade-old wanted posters, until his eyes fell on a large wooden counter marked Rosa Poundcook, postmistress. On the far side of the counter sat the woman herself, gray head bent over a cross-stitch panel of a four-masted schooner. Wapner realized with surprise that there was no line, that in fact he was the only patron in the place.
"Excuse me," he said, approaching the counter. "This is the post office, right?"
"Yes, indeed," said Rosa, tightening one last stitch and carefully laying the panel on the arm of her rocker before raising her eyes. When she saw Wapner, she gave a start.
"Oh my," she said, a hand moving involuntarily to her chin, as if to reassure herself that Wapner's straggly goatee wasn't catching. "That's good, because I'm expecting an important package by courier. See?"
Wapner squinted at her from across the counter.
"The Pony Express delivers to these parts, doesn't it?"
"Oh," Rosa Poundcook repeated, rising from her rocker and knocking the cross-stitch frame askew.
"Do you have a name? I mean, may I have your name, please?"
Wapner let out a short nasal laugh. "It's Wapner. Carrie Wapner."
"Wapner?"
She began searching through a small wooden card file filled with yellow slips.
"W-H-O-P-P."
No. "Wapner. No H. One P," came the annoyed response.
"I see," said Rosa, her composure recovering as she found the slip. "Just a moment."
Taking one last wondering look at the programmer, she disappeared through a door in the back. Wapner lounged against the counter, whistling again, as the screen door creaked open in protest. Glancing over, he saw a tall, skinny man shut the door carefully behind him. The man turned around, and Wapner was immediately reminded of Abraham Lincoln. Gaunt, hollow-eyed, loose-limbed. He wore a clerical collar under a simple black suit and held a small sheaf of letters in one hand. Wapner looked away quickly, but it was too late. Eye contact had been made, and he saw with alarm that the man was already walking over to him. Wapner had never met a priest before, let alone spoken to one, and he had no intention of starting now. He hurriedly reached for a nearby stack of postal publications and began to read intently about the new line of Amish quilt stamps. "Hello," he heard the man say. Turning reluctantly, Wapner found the priest standing directly behind him, one hand outstretched, a narrow smile creasing his pinched face.
"Yeah, hey," he said, giving the hand a limp shake and quickly returning to his publication.
"I'm Woody Clay," the man said. "Okay," Wapner said, not looking at him.
"And you must be one of the Thalassa crew," said Clay, stepping up to the counter beside Wapner.
"Right. Sure am." Wapner flipped over the brochure as a diversionary tactic while he slid a foot farther away from the stranger.
"Mind if I ask you a question?"
"No. Shoot," said Wapner as he read. He'd never known there were so many different kinds of blankets in the whole world.
"Do you really expect to recover a fortune in gold?"
Wapner looked up from the brochure.
"Well, I plan to do a pretty good imitation of it."
The man didn't smile. Sure, I expect to. Why not?
Why not? Shouldn't the question be why?
Something in the man's tone disconcerted Wapner.
What do you mean, why? It's $2 billion.
$2 billion, the man repeated, momentarily surprised. Then he nodded, as if in affirmation of something he'd suspected. So it's just for the money. There's no other reason.
Wapner laughed. Just for the money? You need a better reason. Let's be realistic. I mean, you're not talking to Mother Teresa here, for Christ's sakes.
Suddenly he remembered the clerical collar.
Oh, sorry, he said, abashed. I didn't mean you being a priest and all. It's just...
The man gave a clipped smile.
It's all right. I've heard it before. And I'm not a priest. I'm a congregational minister.
I see, said Wapner.
That's some kind of sect, right? Is the money really that important to you?
Clay gazed at Wapner steadily.
Under the circumstances, I mean.
Wapner returned the look.
What circumstances?
He glanced nervously into the bowels of the post office. What the hell was taking that fat lady so long anyway? She'd have had time to walk to friggin' Brooklyn by now. The man leaned forward.
So what do you do for Thalassa?
I run the computers.
Ah, that must be interesting.
Wapner shrugged.
Yeah, when they work.
As he listened, the man's face became a picture of concern.
And everything's running smoothly. No complaints.
Wapner frowned.
No,
he said guardedly. Clay nodded.
Good.
Wapner put the brochure back on the counter.
Why are you asking anyway?
He said with feigned nonchalance.
No reason,
the minister replied.
Nothing important, anyway.
Except... He paused. Wapner craned his neck forward slightly.
In the past, that island... Well, it created difficulties for anyone who set foot on it. Boilers exploded. Machines failed without any reason. People got hurt. People got killed.
Wapner stepped back with a snort.
You're talking about the Ragged Island curse, he said.
The curse stone and all that stuff.
It's a load of bull poop, if you'll excuse my French.
Clay's eyebrows shot up.
Is it now? Well, there are people who've been here a lot longer than you who don't think so.
And as for the stone, it's locked in the basement of my church right now, where it's been for the last 100 years.
Really?
Wapner asked, mouth open. Clay nodded. There was a silence. The minister leaned closer and lowered his voice conspiratorially.
Ever wonder why there's no lobster buoys around that island?
You mean those things floating on the water everywhere?
That's right. I never noticed there weren't any.
Next time you go out there, take a look. Clay dropped his voice even further.
There's a good reason for that.
Yeah?
It happened about 100 years ago. As I heard it, there was a lobsterman named Hiram Colcord. He used to drop his pots around Ragged Island. Everybody warned him not to, but the lobstering was fine, and he said he didn't give a fig for any curse.
One summer day, not unlike this one, he disappeared into that mist to set his traps. Around sundown, his boat came drifting back out on the tide. Only this time, he wasn't on it. There were lobster traps piled up and a barrel full of live lobsters. But no Colcord. They found his lunch, half-eaten on the galley board,
and a half-drunk bottle of beer left as if he'd just stood up and walked away. He fell overboard and got his butt drowned. So what?
No,
Clay continued. Because that evening his brother went out to the island to see if Hiram had been stranded somehow. He never came back either. The next day, his boat drifted out of the mists. Wapner swallowed. So they both fell out and drowned. 2 weeks later, Clay said, their bodies washed up on Breed's Point. One of the locals who saw what had happened went mad with fright, and none of the rest would say what they had seen. Not ever.
Come on, said Wapner, nervously.
People said it wasn't just the pit that guarded the treasure now. Understand? You know that terrible sound the island makes every time the tide changes? They say... There was a bustling noise from the rear of the house.
Sorry I took so long,
panted Rosa as she emerged, a package tucked under one plump arm.
It was under that load of bird feeders for the coast to coast, and with Eustace down at the pound this morning, you know, I had to shift everything myself.
Hey, no problem. Thanks. Wapner grabbed the package gratefully and headed quickly for the door.
Excuse me, mister, the postmistress said.
Wapner stopped short. Then, unwillingly, he looked around, the package clasped to his chest. The woman was holding out the yellow sheet.
You have to sign for it.
Wordlessly, Wapner stepped forward and scrawled a hasty signature. Then, turning away again, he moved quickly out of the parlor, letting the screen door slam behind him. Once outside, he took a deep breath. The hell with this, he muttered. Priest or no priest, he wasn't going back to the boat until he'd made sure they hadn't screwed up his order again. He wrestled with the small box, tugging at the tab, first gingerly, then enthusiastically. The seam of the box gave way suddenly, and a dozen role-playing figurines spilled out, wizards and sorcerers clattering across the cobbles at his feet. Fluttering after them came a pack of gamers' witching cards. Pentagrams, spells, reverse prayers, devil's circles. With a cry and a curse, Wapner stooped to pick them up. Clay stepped outside, once again shutting the door carefully behind him. He stepped off the porch and into the street, took one long look at the plastic figurines and the cards, then hurried up the lane without another word.
Chapter 22.
The following day was cool and damp, but by the end of the afternoon the drizzle had lifted and low clouds were scudding across a freshening sky. Tomorrow will be crisp and windy, Hatch thought as he strode up the narrow yellow-taped path behind Orthanc. This daily hike to the top of the island had become a closing ritual for him. Reaching the height of land, he walked around the edge of the southern bluffs until he had a good view of Streeter's crew, wrapping up the day's work on the offshore cofferdam. As usual, Needleman had come up with a simple but elegant plan. While the cargo vessel was dispatched to Portland for cement and building materials, Bonterre had mapped out the exact lie of the ancient pirate cofferdam, taking samples for later archaeological analysis. Next, divers had poured an underwater concrete footing directly atop the remains of the old foundation. This had been followed by the sinking of steel I-beams into the footing. Hatch stared at the enormous beams, rising vertically out of the water at 10-foot intervals, forming a narrow arc around the southern end of the island. From his vantage point, he could see Streeter in the cab of the floating crane, positioned near the barge and just outside the row of steel beams. A massive section of reinforced concrete dangled from the crane's sling. As Hatch watched, Streeter maneuvered the rectangle of concrete into the slot formed by two of the I-beams, then slid it home. Once it was securely in place, two divers unhooked the slings. Then, Streeter deftly swung the crane around toward the barge, where more sections of concrete were waiting. There was a flash of red hair.
Hatch could see that one of the deckhands on the barge was Johnny Truitt. Needleman had found work for him despite the delay in draining the pit, and Hatch was pleased that Donnie seemed to be working efficiently. There was a roar from the floating crane as Streeter swung it back toward the semicircle of beams, slotting a new piece of concrete into place beside the other. When the cofferdam was finished, Hatch knew, it would completely enclose the southern end of the island and the flood tunnel exits. Then the water pit and all its connected underwater works could be pumped dry, with the dam holding back the sea, just as the pirates' cofferdam had done 300 years before. A whistle sounded, signaling quitting time. The crew on the barge began throwing tie-downs over the stacked sections of cofferdam while the waiting tugboat came in out of the offshore mist to tow the crane toward the dock. Hatch took a final look around and turned back down the trail toward base camp. He stopped in at his office, collected his bag and locked the door, then headed toward the dock. He'd have a simple dinner at home, he decided, then head into town and look up Bill Banns. The next issue of the Stormhaven Gazette was due out shortly, and Hatch wanted to make sure the old man had plenty of appropriate copy for the front page. The mooring at the safest section of the reef had been enlarged and Hatch given a berth. As he started the engine of the Plain Jane and prepared to cast off, he heard a nearby voice cry, "Ahoy, the frigate!" Looking up, he saw Bonterre coming down the dock toward him, dressed in bib overalls and wearing a red bandana around her neck. Mud was splashed generously across her clothes, hands, and face. She stopped at the foot of the dock, then stuck out her thumb like a hitchhiker, impishly raising one pant leg to expose a foot or so of tan calf. "Need a lift?" Hatch asked. "How did you guess?" Bonterre replied, tossing her bag into the boat and jumping in. "I am already sick of your ugly old island." Hatch cast off and heeled the boat around, easing it past the reefs and through the inlet. "Your tummy healing up?" "There is a nasty scab on my otherwise beautiful stomach." "Don't worry. It's nothing permanent." Hatch took another look at her dirty coveralls. "Making mud pies?" Bonterre frowned.
"Mud pies? You know, playing in the mud."
She snorted a laugh.
"Of course. It is what archaeologists do best."
"So I see." They were approaching the thin circle of mist, and Hatch throttled down until they were clear. "I didn't see you out among the divers." Bonterre snorted again.
"I am an archaeologist first, a diver second. I've done the important work, grinding out the old cofferdam. Sergio and his friends can do the labor of the beasts."
"I'll tell him you said that." Hatch brought the boat through Old Hump Channel and swung it around Hermit Island. Stormhaven Harbor came into view, a shining strip of white and green against the dark blue of the ocean. Leaning against the fantail, Bonterre shook out her hair, a glossy cascade of black.
"So what is there to do in this one-horse town?" she said, nodding toward the mainland.
"Not much."
"No disco dancing until 3? Merde. What is a single woman to do?"
"I admit, it's a difficult problem," Hatch replied, resisting the impulse to return her flirtations.
"Don't forget, this woman is trouble."
She looked at him, a tiny smile curling the corners of her lips.
"Well, I could have dinner with the doctor."
"Doctor?" Hatch said with mock surprise. "Why, I suppose Dr. Fraser would be delighted. For 60, he's still pretty spry."
"You bad boy. I meant this doctor."
She poked him playfully in the chest. Hatch looked at her. "Why not?" he thought. "What kind of trouble could I get into over dinner?" "There are only 2 restaurants in town, you know. Both seafood places, naturally. Although one does a reasonable steak."
"Steak? That is for me. I am a strict carnivore. Vegetables are for pigs and monkeys. As for fish,
She made an elaborate gesture of retching over the side.
I thought you grew up in the Caribbean.
Yes, and my father was a fisherman, and that is all we ate forever and ever. Except at Christmas, when we had chevreux.
Goat? Hatch asked.
Yes, I love goat. Cooked for 8 hours in a hole on the beach, washed down with homemade punlak beer.
Delectable, said Hatch, laughing. You're staying in town, right?
Yes. Everything was booked up, so I placed a notice in the post office. The lady behind the counter saw it and offered me a room.
You mean upstairs? At the Pound Cook's?
Not a lemon.
The postmistress and her husband. They're a nice, quiet couple.
Yes. Sometimes I think they might be dead. It's so quiet downstairs.
Wait and see what happens if you try to bring home a man, thought Hatch. Or even if you stay out after 11. They reached the harbor, and Hatch eased the boat up to its mooring.
I must change out of these dirty clothes, Bonterre said, leaping into the dinghy. And, of course, you must put on something better than that boring old blazer.
But I like this jacket, Hatch protested.
You American men do not know how to dress at all. What you need is a good suit of Italian linen.
I hate linen, Hatch said. It's always wrinkled.
That is the point,
Bonterre laughed.
What size are you? 42 long?
How did you know?
I am good at measuring a man.
Chapter 23 Hatch picked her up outside the post office, and they walked down the steep, cobbled streets toward the landing. It was a beautiful, cool evening. The clouds had blown away, and a vast bowl of stars hung over the harbor. In the clear evening light, with the little yellow lights of the town twinkling in windows and above doorways, Stormhaven seemed to Hatch like a place from a remote and friendlier past.
"This is truly a charming place," Bonterre said as she took his arm. "Saint-Pierre, where I grew up on Martinique, is also beautiful. But, alors, such a difference. It is all lights and colors. Not like here, where everything is black and white. And there is much to do there. Very good nightclubs for wild times."
"I don't like nightclubs," said Hatch.
"How boring," said Bonterre, good-naturedly.
They arrived at the restaurant, and the waiter, recognizing Hatch, seated them immediately. It was a cozy place. 2 rambling rooms and a bar, decorated with nets, wooden lobster pots, and glass floats. Taking a seat, Hatch looked around. Fully a third of the patrons were Thalassa employees.
"Good monde," Bonterre whispered. "One cannot get away from company people. I cannot wait for Gerard to send them all home."
"It's like that in a small town. The only way you can get away is to go out on the water. And even then, there's always someone in the town looking at you with a telescope."
"No sex on deck, then," said Bonterre.
"No," said Hatch. "We New Englanders always have sex below." He watched her break into a delighted smile, and he wondered what kind of havoc she'd wreak among the male crew in the days to come. "So what was it you did today that made you so dirty?"
"What is this obsession with dirt?"
She frowned.
"Mud is the archaeologist's friend."
She leaned across the table.
"As it happens, I made a little discovery on your muddy old island."
"Tell me about it." She took a sip from her water glass.
"We discovered the pirate encampment."
Hatch looked at her. "You're kidding."
"Mais non. This morning, we set out to examine the windward side of the island. You know that spot where a large bluff stands off by itself, maybe 10 meters down the rocks?"
"Yes."
"Right there, where the bluff was eroding, there was a perfect soil profile. A vertical cut, very convenient to the archaeologist. I was able to locate a lens of charcoal.
Hatch frowned.
A what?
You know. A black lens of charcoal. The remains of an ancient fire. So we ran a metal detector across this site, and right then began finding things. Grape shot, a musket ball, and several horseshoe nails.
She ticked the items on her fingers.
Horseshoe nails?
Yes. They used horses for the heavy work.
Where did they get them?
Are you so ignorant of naval history, Monsieur le Docteur? It was common to carry livestock on ships. Horses, goats, chickens, pigs.
Their dinners arrived. Steamers and lobsters for Hatch, a bloody top sirloin for Bonterre. The archaeologist tucked into the food at an alarming rate, and Hatch watched her eat with amusement, juice dripping from her chin, a furrowed, intent look in her face.
Anyway,
she went on, spearing an extravagantly large morsel of steak with her fork. After those discoveries, we dug a test trench just behind the bluffs.
And what do you think?
More charcoal. A circular tent depression. A few broken turkey and deer bones. Rankin has some fancy sensors he wants to drag over to the site, in case we miss any spots. But meanwhile, we have graded the camp and will start excavation tomorrow. My little Christophe is becoming an excellent digger.
St. John?
Digging?
But of course.
I made him get rid of those horrid shoes and jacket. Once he resigned himself to getting his hands dirty, he proved most able. Now he is my prime digger. He follows me everywhere and comes when I whistle.
She laughed in a kindly way.
Don't be too hard on the poor man.
Au contraire, I am doing him good. He needs the fresh air and the exercise, or he will stay as white and fat as a grub.
You wait. When I am through with him, he will be all wire and gristle, like le petit homme.
Who? You know. The little man.
The corners of Bonterre's mouth turned down impishly.
Streeter.
Ah. The way Bonterre said it, Hatch could tell the nickname wasn't meant fondly. What's his story, anyway?
Bonterre shrugged. One hears things. Hard to know what is the truth and what is not. He was under Needleman in Vietnam.
That is how you say it, no?
Somebody told me that Needleman once saved his life during combat. That story is one I believe.
You see how devoted he is to the captain?
Like a dog to his master.
He is the only one the captain really trusts.
She stared at Hatch.
Except for you, of course.
Hatch frowned.
Well, I suppose it's good the captain cares about him. Somebody has to. I mean, the guy's not exactly Mr. Personality.
Bonterre raised her eyebrows.
Certainement.
And I can see that the two of you got off on the other foot.
The wrong foot, Hatch corrected.
Whatever.
But you are wrong when you say that Captain Needleman cares about Streeter. There is only one thing he cares about.
She gave the briefest of nods in the direction of Ragged Island.
He does not talk about it much, but only an imbecile would not see. Do you know that, as long as I have known him, he has had a small photograph of your island, sitting on his desk at the Lassa?
No, I didn't. Hatch's thoughts went back to the first trip out to the island with Needleman.
What was it the captain had said?
I didn't want to see it unless we'd have the chance to dig it.
Something seemed to have upset Bonterre. As Hatch opened his mouth to change the subject, he sensed something, someone, a presence across the room. And when he looked up, there was Claire, coming around the corner. The intended remark died on his lips.
She was just as he'd imagined she would be,
tall and willowy, with the same dash of freckles across the upturned nose. She saw him and stopped dead, her face wrinkling into that same funny frown of surprise he remembered. "Hello, Claire," Hatch said, standing up awkwardly and trying to keep his voice neutral. She stepped forward. "Hello," she said, shaking his hand, and at the touch of his skin against hers, a pink flush formed on her cheeks. "I heard you were in town." She gave a self-deprecating laugh. "Of course, who hasn't? I mean, with all that..." And she made a vague gesture over her shoulder, as if to indicate the water pit. "You look great," Hatch said. And she did. The years had made her slender and turned her dark blue eyes a penetrating gray. The mischievous smile once etched permanently on her lips had given way to a more serious, introspective look. She smoothed her pleated skirt unconsciously as she felt his eyes on her. There was movement at the restaurant entrance. Then the minister, Woody Clay, stepped in. He looked around the room until his eyes landed on Hatch. A spasm of displeasure moved quickly across his sallow face, and he came forward. "Not here," Hatch thought, bracing himself for another lecture about greed and the ethics of treasure hunting. Sure enough, the minister stopped at their table, glancing from Hatch to Bonterre and back. Hatch wondered if the man would actually have the gall to interrupt their dinner. "Oh," said Claire, looking at the minister and touching her long blonde hair. "Woody, this is Mellon Hatch."
"We've met." Clay nodded.
With relief, Hatch realized it wasn't likely that Clay would launch into another tirade with the two women looking on.
"This is Dr. Isabel Bonterre," he said, recovering his composure. "May I introduce Claire Northcutt and..."
"Reverend and Mrs. Woodruff Clay," said the minister crisply, extending his hand to Bonterre. Hatch was stunned, his mind almost refusing to accept this fresh surprise. Bonterre dabbed at her lips with a napkin and stood up with a languid motion, giving Claire and Woody each a hearty handshake, exposing a row of dazzling teeth. There was an awkward pause, and then Clay ushered his wife away with a curt nod to Hatch. Bonterre glanced at the retreating figure of Claire, then back at Hatch.
"Old friends?" she asked.
"What?" Hatch murmured. He was staring at Clay's left hand, possessively placed in the small of Claire's back. An arch smile formed on Bonterre's face.
"No. I can see I am wrong," she said, leaning over the table. "Old lovers. How awkward it is to meet again. And yet, how sweet."
"You have a keen eye," mumbled Hatch, still too off balance from the encounter, and the revelation that followed to make any kind of denial.
"But you and the husband, you are not old friends. In fact, it seemed to me that he does not like you at all. That tiresome frown, and those big black bags under his eyes. He looks like he had a nuit blanche."
"A what?"
"A nuit blanche. A,
how do you say it?
A sleepless night.
For one reason or another." She smiled wickedly. Instead of replying, Hatch picked up his fork and tried to busy himself with his lobster.
"I can see you still carry her torch," Bonterre purred, with a cheerful smile. "Some day, you must tell me of her. But first, let me hear about you. The captains mentioned your travels. So tell me all about your adventures in Suriname."
Almost 2 hours later, Hatch forced himself to his feet and followed Bonterre out of the restaurant. He had overindulged ridiculously, obscenely. 2 desserts, 2 pots of coffee, 7 brandies. Bonterre had matched him enthusiastically, order for order, yet she did not seem any worse for wear as she threw open her arms and breathed in the crisp night breeze.
"How refreshing this air is," she cried. "I could almost learn to love a place like this."
"Just wait," Hatch replied. "Another 2 weeks and you won't be able to leave. It gets in your blood."
"Another 2 weeks, and you will not be able to get out of my way fast enough, Monsieur le Docteur."
She looked at him appraisingly.
"So what do we do now?"
Hatch hesitated a moment. He'd never thought about what might happen after dinner. He returned the gaze, warning bells once again sounding faintly in his head. Silhouetted in the yellow glow of the street lamps, the archaeologist looked captivatingly beautiful, her tawny skin and almond eyes bewitchingly exotic in the small main village.
"Careful," the voice said. "I think we say goodnight," he managed to say.
"We've got a busy day tomorrow." Immediately, her eyebrows creased in an exaggerated frown.
"C'est tout," she pouted. "You Yankees have had all the marrow sucked from your bones. I should have gone out with Sergio. He at least has the fire in the belly, even if his body odor could kill a goat."
She squinted up at him.
"So how exactly do you say goodnight in Stormhaven, Dr. Hatch?"
"Like this." Hatch stepped forward and gave her hand a shake.
"Ah."
Bonterre nodded slowly, as if comprehending.
"I see."
Then, quickly, she took his face in her hands and pulled it toward her, letting her lips graze his. As her hands dropped away from his face caressingly, Hatch could feel the tip of her tongue flick teasingly against his for the briefest of moments.
"And that is how we say goodnight in Martinique," she murmured.
Then she turned in the direction of the post office and, without glancing back, walked into the night.
Chapter 24. The following afternoon, as Hatch came up the path from the dock after treating a diver's sprained wrist, he heard a crash resound from the direction of Wapner's hut. Hatch sprinted into base camp, fearing the worst. But instead of finding the programmer pinned beneath a large rack of equipment, he found him sitting back in his chair, a shattered CPU at his feet, eating an ice cream sandwich, an irritated expression on his face. "Is everything all right?" Wapner chewed noisily. "No," he said. "What happened?" The programmer turned a pair of large, mournful eyes toward Hatch. "That computer impacted with my foot is what happened." Hatch looked around for a place to sit, remembered there was none, and leaned against the doorway. "Tell me about it." Wapner shoved the last piece in his mouth and dropped the wrapper on the floor.
"It's all messed up."
"What is?"
"Charybdis.
The Ragged Island Network." Wapner jerked a thumb in the direction of Island One. "How so?"
"I've been running my brute force program against that goddamn second code. Even with increased priority, the routines were sluggish, and I was getting error messages. Strange data. So I tried running the same routines remotely over on Scylla, the Cerberus computer. It ran lickety-split. No errors."
He gave a disgusted scoff. "Any idea what the problem is?"
"Yeah. I got a good idea. I ran some low-level diagnostics. Some of the ROM microcode was rewritten. Just like when the pumps went haywire. Rewritten randomly, in bursts of a regular Fourier pattern."
"I'm not following you."
"Basically, it's not possible. Follow that. There's no known process that can rewrite ROM that way. And on top of that, in a regular mathematical pattern?"
Wapner stood up, opened the door to what looked like a refrigerated corpse locker, and slipped out another ice cream sandwich.
"And the same thing's happening to my hard disks and magneto-opticals. It only happens here. Not on the boat. Not in Brooklyn. Just here."
"You can't tell me it's not possible. I mean, you saw it happen. You just don't know why yet."
"Oh, I know why. The friggin' Ragged Island curse."
Hatch laughed, then saw Wapner was not smiling.
The programmer unwrapped the ice cream and took a massive bite.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Show me another reason and I'll buy into it. But everyone who's come to this goddamn place has had things go wrong. Unexplainable things. When you get right down to it, we're no different from the rest. We just have newer toys.
Hatch had never heard Wapner talk like this.
What's gotten into you? He asked.
Nothing's gotten into me. That priest explained the whole thing. I ran into him at the post office yesterday.
So Clay's been talking to Thalassa employees now. Spreading his poison, Hatch thought, surprised at the strength of his anger. The man's an irritant. Someone ought to squeeze him like a sebaceous cyst. His thoughts were interrupted when St. John appeared in the doorway.
There you are,
he said to Hatch. Hatch stared back. The historian was dressed in a bizarre combination of muddy Wellingtons, old tweed, and Maine oilcloth. His chest was heaving from exertion.
What is it? Hatch asked, rising instinctively, expecting to hear that there had been another accident.
Why, nothing serious, said St. John, self-consciously smoothing down the front of his sou'wester. Isabel sent me to bring you to our dig.
Our dig?
Yes. You probably know I've been helping Isabel with the excavation of the pirate encampment.
Isabel this, Isabel that. Hatch found himself mildly annoyed by the historian's familiar attitude toward Bonterre. St. John turned to Wapner.
Did the program finish executing on the Cerberus computer?
Wapner nodded.
No errors.
No luck, either.
Then, Carrie, there's no choice but to try.
I'm not going to rewrite the program for polyalphabetics, Wapner said, giving the ruined CPU a childish kick. It's too much work for nothing. We're running out of time as it is. Just a minute, Hatch said, trying to defuse the argument before it started. St. John was telling me about polyalphabetic codes.
Then he was wasting his breath, Wapner replied. They didn't become popular until the end of the 19th century. People thought they were too error-prone, too slow. Besides, where would Macallan have hidden all his code tables? He couldn't have memorized the hundreds of letter sequences himself.
Hatch sighed. I don't know much about codes, but I know a little about human nature. From what Captain Needleman's been saying, this Macallan was a real visionary. We know he changed codes halfway through in order to protect his secret.
So it stands to reason he would have changed to a more difficult code, St. John interrupted.
We know that, dummy, Wapner snapped.
What do you think we've been trying to crack for the last 2 weeks?
Hush up a minute, Hatch went on. We also know that Macallan switched to a code containing all numbers.
So?
So Macallan wasn't only a visionary, he was also a pragmatist. You've been approaching this second code as just a technical problem. But what if there's more to it than that? Could there be some pressing reason why Macallan used only numbers in the new code? There was a sudden silence in the hut as the cryptologist and the historian fell into thought.
No,
Wapner said after a moment.
Yes, St. John cried, snapping his fingers. He used numbers to conceal his code tables.
What are you talking about? Wapner grumbled.
Look, Macallan was ahead of his time. He knew that polyalphabetics were the strongest codes around, but to use them, he needed several cipher alphabets, not just one. But he couldn't leave a lot of alphabet tables lying around where they might be discovered. So he used numbers. He was an architect and an engineer. He was supposed to have lots of numbers around. Mathematical tables, blueprints, hydraulic equations. Any one of those could have done double duty, concealing a code table, and nobody would have been the wiser.
St. John's voice had a clear, excited ring to it, and there was an eager flush on his face Hatch hadn't seen before. Wapner noticed it, too. He sat forward, the forgotten ice cream sandwich melting into a brown and white pool on his desk.
You might have something there, Chris, old boy, he muttered. I'm not saying you do, but you might. He pulled the keyboard toward him. Tell you what. I'll reprogram the Cerberus computer to try a chosen plaintext attack on the code. Now you boys let me be, okay? I'm busy. Hatch accompanied St. John out of the hut and into the drizzle that cloaked base camp. It was one of those New England days when the moisture seemed to congeal out of the air itself.
I should thank you, the historian said, pulling the sou'wester tighter around his plump face. That was a good idea you had, you know. Besides, he'd never have listened to me. I was thinking about bringing the captain into it.
I don't know if I did anything, but you're welcome. Hatch paused. Didn't you say that Isabel was looking for me? St. John nodded.
She said to say we've got a patient for you at the far end of the island.
Hatch started.
Patient? Why didn't you tell me first thing? It's not urgent, said St. John with a knowing smile. No, I wouldn't call it urgent at all.
Chapter 25. As they mounted the rise of land, Hatch glanced southward. The cofferdam had been completed, and Streeter's crew was now working on the massive pumps arrayed along the western shore, tuning them up after their recent ordeal and preparing them for use again the next day. Orthanc stood gray and indistinct, the illumination from the observation tower casting a greenish-neon glow into the surrounding mists. Hatch could see the faint shadow of someone moving about inside. They topped the crown of the island and descended toward the east, following a muddy path that wound its way through an especially dense area of old shafts. The excavation site itself was spread across a flat meadow, lying behind a sharp bluff on the eastern shore. A portable storage shed was standing on a platform of concrete blocks at the far end of the meadow. In front of it, the heavy grass had been trampled flat, and a great checkerboard grid had been marked out in white string across an acre of ground. Several large tarps lay in a disorganized heap. Here and there, Hatch could see that some of the meter-square grids had already been opened, exposing rich, iron-stained earth that contrasted sharply with the wet grass. Bonterre and several diggers were crowded together on an earthen balk beside one of the squares, their slicker-clad backs glistening, while another excavator was cutting out the sod in an adjacent square. A few large orange markers had been posted beyond the grid site. It's a perfect spot for a pirate encampment, Hatch thought, hidden from both the sea and the mainland. 100 yards from the site, the ATV had been parked at a crazy angle on the rough ground, a large gray box trailer in tow. Several large pieces of equipment on 3-wheeled carts were lined up behind. Rankin was kneeling beside one, preparing to winch it back into the trailer. "Where'd these toys come from?" Hatch asked, nodding at the equipment. Rankin grinned.
"The Cerberus, man. Where else?" "Tomographic detectors."
"Come again?"
The grin widened.
"You know, ground-penetrating sensors."
He began pointing to the various carts.
"You got your ground-penetrating radar. Good resolution of bodies and, say, mines up to 12 feet or so, depending on the wavelength. Next to it is an infrared reflector. Good in sand, but with relatively low saturation. And there at the end is..."
"Okay, okay. I get the idea."
Hatch laughed. "All for non-metallic stuff, right?"
"You got it. Never thought I'd get a chance to use any of it on this gig. As it was, Isabel nearly had all the fun to herself."
Rankin pointed at the orange markers.
"You can see, I found a few scraps here and there, but she'd already struck the motherlode."
Hatch waved goodbye and trotted ahead to catch St. John. As they walked down to the site, Bonterre detached herself from the group and came over, slipping a handpick into her belt and wiping her muddy hands on her rear. Her hair was tied back and her face and tawny arms were again smeared with dirt.
"I found Dr. Hatch," said St. John unnecessarily, a sheepish grin on his face. "Thank you, Christophe."
Hatch wondered at the sheepish grin.
Surely St. John hadn't become the latest victim of Bonterre's charms. But nothing else, he realized, could possibly have pried the man away from his books to grub about in the mud and rain.
Come, she said, grabbing Hatch's hand and pulling him toward the edge of the pit.
Move aside, she barked amiably at the workers. The doctor is here. Clear up your loose.
What's this?
Hatch asked in amazement, gazing down at a dirty brown skull rearing out of the dirt, along with what looked like 2 feet and a jumble of other ancient bones.
Pirate grave, she said triumphantly. Jump in, but do not step on anything.
So this is the patient. Hatch climbed down into the excavated square. He examined the skull for a moment with interest, then turned his attention to the other bones. Or should I say patience?
Pardon?
Hatch looked up. Unless this pirate had 2 right feet. You've got 2 skeletons here.
2? That is vachement bien,
cried Bonterre, clapping her hands. Were they murdered? Hatch asked.
Monsieur le docteur, that is your department.
Hatch knelt and examined the bones more closely. A brass buckle lay on a nearby pelvis, and several brass buttons were scattered across what remained of a rib cage, along with an unraveling string of gold piping. He tapped the skull slightly, careful not to prise it from the surrounding matrix. It was turned to one side, mouth gaping open. There were no obvious pathologies. No musket ball holes, broken bones, cutlass marks, or other signs of violence. He couldn't really be sure what killed the pirate until the excavation was complete and the bones had been removed. On the other hand, it was clear that the original body had been buried in haste, even thrown into the grave. The arms lay askew, the head was turned, and the legs bent. He wondered for a moment if the rest of the second skeleton lay beneath. Then his eyes were suddenly arrested by a golden gleam near one of the feet.
"What's this?"
he asked. A compact mass of gold coins and a large carved gemstone lay embedded in the earth near the lower tibia. Only a little of the soil had been brushed away, keeping the coins in situ. A peal of laughter came from Bonterre.
"I was wondering when you would see that. I believe the gentleman must have kept a pouch in his boot. Between Christophe and myself, we have identified them all. A gold mohur from India, 2 English guineas, a French louis d'or, and 4 Portuguese cruzados, all dating prior to 1694. The stone is an emerald, probably Inca from Peru, carved into the head of a jaguar. It must have given the pirate quite a blister."
"So this is it at last," breathed Hatch.
"The first of Edward Ockham's treasure."
"Yes,"
she replied more soberly. "Now, it is fact." As Hatch stared at the compact mass of gold, in itself a small numismatic fortune, a strange tingling began at the base of his spine. What had always seemed theoretical, even academic, was suddenly real.
"Does the captain know about this?" he asked.
"Not yet. Come, there is more to see."
But Hatch could not take his eyes off the fresh, thick gleam of metal.
"What is it,"
he thought, "that makes the sight so compelling?" There was something almost atavistic in the human response to gold. Shaking the thought from his head, he climbed out of the excavated square.
"Now you must see the pirate camp itself," Bonterre said, slipping her arm into his elbow. "For it is stranger yet."
Hatch followed her toward another section of the dig, a few dozen yards off. It didn't look like much. The grass and topsoil had been cleared from an area perhaps 100 yards square, leaving a brown, hard-packed dirt floor. He could see several blackened areas of charcoal, where fires had evidently been lit, and numerous circular depressions dug into the soil in no regular order. Countless tiny plastic flags had been stuck in the ground, each containing a number written in black marker.
"Those round areas were probably tent depressions," Bonterre said, "where the workers who built the water pit lived. But look at all the artifacts that were left behind. Each flag marks a discovery, and we have been at work less than 2 days.
She led Hatch to the far side of the storage shed, where a large tarp had been laid. She peeled it back, and Hatch looked down in astonishment. Dozens of artifacts had been laid out in neat rows, each numbered and tagged.
2 flintlock pistols, she said, pointing. 3 daggers, 2 boarding axes, a cutlass, and a blunderbuss. A cask of grape shot and several bags of musket balls. 12 pieces of 8, several items of silver.